China has to appear strong in the face of Donald Trump, otherwise it's going to end up, it feels it would end up giving too much away in negotiation.
Trade posturing continues in a trade of words between the United States and China. It's Friday, April 13th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, kinder, gentler military exercises in Korea. Australia warns of military expansion on islands. We meet extraordinary Pakistanis. Hollywood quality wedding videos and diverting dirty water. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A Chinese Commerce Ministry spokesman on Thursday warned Beijing will fight back if the United States escalates trade tensions. Gao Feng said China's resolution and confidence in firmly safeguarding the interests of the country and its people will not change. He said China is prepared to fight back steadfastly. Referring to remarks earlier this week by President Xi Jinping, who promised to open up the Chinese economy, Gao Feng said it is completely misleading to see that as a concession to the United States. It reflects the country's current development level and has nothing to do with economic and trade friction with Washington. Shane Oliver, chief economist and strategist at the Sydney-based AMP Capital, tells VOA's Victor Beattie this appears to be a case of China playing, quote, good cop, bad cop, and is part of its negotiating strategy with the United States.
China has to appear strong in the face of Donald Trump, otherwise it's going to end up, it feels it would end up giving too much away in negotiations. So that's why you're hearing comments from the Commerce Department, for example. And of course, a few weeks ago, the last few weeks, the Chinese ambassador to Washington has said exactly the same thing, that China will retaliate in proportion to whatever the US does or announces. But by the same token, the Chinese leadership, I think, is quite clearly aware of the issue that it does need to continue to open things up, not just to appease President Trump, but more importantly, I think, to see the ongoing development of the Chinese economy. And of course, that's what President Xi reiterated earlier this week. So I think, yes, we are seeing what appears to be disparate messages, but I think it's a classic case of good cop, bad cop. I think ultimately China is open to negotiation with the U.S. on this issue, and I think ultimately that's the way it's going to be resolved.
The Commerce Ministry spokesman said that Mr. Xi was merely outlining China's strategy to open up further and had nothing to do with trade frictions with Washington.
China has been opening up over many, many years, but I think there's no doubt that the Chinese leadership would nevertheless be aware of the issues with the U.S. And, of course, it is noteworthy that President Xi's comments did make reference to intellectual property, as did Premier Li's comments a few weeks ago, particularly pledging to respect intellectual property. And that, of course, I think is a clear reference to some of the gripes that President Trump has in relation to China. I don't think they would have made that reference were it not for the Americans mentioning this issue. But I do think, you know, we're going to hear this ongoing, that sort of stuff going on. But I think at the end of the day, the Chinese are open to negotiation on these issues. I think ultimately that's the way it will go. But yes, this sort of sniping will continue. And quite clearly, we still have a way to go before these negotiations actually happen. I don't think they're happening at the moment. And before we get a result.
President Trump tweeted on Monday that China's maintaining 25% import tariffs on U.S. auto exports compared to the U.S. 2.5% duties on Chinese automobiles. The Commerce Ministry spokesman said Thursday it's not reasonable to require tariffs to be completely equal for both sides.
Well, that I think is part of the agreement that underpins the World Trade Organization, that's less developed countries, and China is still a lowly developed economy compared to the US, that they're able to maintain higher tariffs than developed countries do. And so it is quite common to have that disparate level of tariffs in place. And China would probably say, well, yeah, we're still being consistent with the World Trade Organization rules. And you'd probably find that many emerging countries like China have similar higher tariffs on U.S. goods than the U.S. would have on goods from those countries.
Shane Oliver said China is under pressure to reduce its tariffs simply by the size of its economy, the world's second largest. In an editorial, the state-run Global Times said Washington has two options. respond to China's determination to open up with goodwill interactions, or hold on to unilateralism pressuring Beijing with unreasonable demands. The United States has proposed tariffs on $50 billion in Chinese imports to lessen the bilateral trade imbalance and address allegations of intellectual property theft. Oliver says those tariffs won't likely be implemented until June, thus allowing plenty of time for negotiating to end what he calls, for now, a phony trade war. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. What does denuclearization mean to North Korea? Fate of political prisoners in Myanmar in president's hands. World Trade Body warns U.S.-China tensions may dent business. Australia says no place for Chinese military bases in Pacific. Amnesty says executions fell, but China still tops list. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The annual U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises currently underway have historically been a very public demonstration of force, intended in part to counter North Korea's aggressive nuclear and missile tests. But with looming diplomatic summits aimed at reaching a deal to end the North's nuclear program, VOA's Brian Patton in Seoul tells us media coverage of the drill so far has been limited.
The U.S. 2nd Infantry Division recently hosted a tree-planting ceremony at Camp Casey in South Korea, located near the inter-Korean border.
And it is my belief that this tree, like those that have come before it, shall symbolize the roots that bind us together and to our past in an enduring way.
There was also a shooting competition to determine the best marksman in the participating U.S. and South Korean divisions. The Camp Casey event illustrates how so far this year the U.S. and South Korean militaries are downplaying the offensive component of the joint training exercises underway that involve thousands of troops.
This is clearly in order to send a signal to North Korea that South Korea and the United States are not willing to escalate the situation any further.
In response to past North Korean ballistic missile and nuclear tests, the joint exercises had featured nuclear-capable aircraft carriers and bombers to demonstrate the ability to respond with overwhelming force to a North Korean attack. But these military assets are not expected to participate this year as diplomatic progress continues for a meeting between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and South Korean President Moon Jae-in at the end of April and for the U.S.-North Korea summit. U.S. President Donald Trump this week confirmed his administration is in contact with Pyongyang and expects to meet with Kim in late May or early June.
I think there'll be great respect paid by both parties and hopefully we'll be able to make a deal on the denuking of North Korea.
The North Korean leader also this week publicly acknowledged the upcoming summits for the first time at a meeting of the ruling Workers' Party of Korea. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Happening in Asia, a pre-dawn Taliban attack has killed a district governor and 7 police personnel in southeastern Afghanistan. The fighting came as the United Nations cautioned the number of conflict-related civilian casualties in the first 3 months of 2018 remained at the same high level recorded last year. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We've reached Friday, and we're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. Australia is warning Vanuatu against allowing China to build a military base in the South Pacific archipelago. Vanuatu has denied it is in talks with Beijing about hosting a Chinese base on its soil, as we hear from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
An Australian newspaper has reported that Vanuatu and China have been in preliminary talks about establishing a military base in the Pacific island nation. Vanuatu's government, however, said the claims were false and that it wasn't interested in militarization or hosting foreign military bases. But the press reports did provoke a reaction at the highest levels of the Australian administration. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull said any foreign bases in the Pacific would be unwelcome.
We would view with great concern the establishment of any foreign military bases in those Pacific Island countries, the neighbours of ours. We put a great effort into the Pacific Islands region. This is a particularly important that we maintain the Pacific, as its name suggests, a peaceful region.
Last year, Chinese ships visited Vanuatu as part of a broader regional mission, but Australian officials said those visits were part of normal diplomatic practices. Analysts believe that any move by the Chinese military to build a base in Vanuatu, which is less than 2,000 kilometres from Australia, would be part of Beijing's attempts to counter US power in the region. Jonathan Holslag is the co-founder of the Brussels Institute of Contemporary China Studies.
China has the intention by 2025 to become a resident power in the Western Pacific by means of its navy, and by 2050 to essentially overtake the United States as an important military player in that region.
Western countries are closely watching China's military expansion after it established its first overseas naval base in Djibouti in the Horn of Africa last year. China maintains the bases for peacekeeping missions in Africa. Academics estimate China had contributed more than $1.7 billion in aid to the Pacific since 2006. Vanuatu, which has a population of just 270,000 people, has backed China's position on the disputed South China Sea. In January, Australia accused China of so-called checkbook diplomacy in the region by funding what Canberra said were useless infrastructure projects across the South Pacific. In response, China lodged a formal diplomatic protest. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, from jewellery to the football field, we meet some special Pakistanis. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the U.S. Embassy in Cambodia has issued a security alert over an alleged plot to set off a bomb during the country's traditional New Year holiday, which runs from Thursday through Monday. Prime Minister Hun Sen had publicly warned of the alleged plot, saying strengthened security measures would ensure safety. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, from a refugee camp in Pakistan to an exhibit at the Smithsonian, Sayeda Etabari has had a remarkable journey, even more extraordinary because she's deaf in a region where there's less opportunity for people with disabilities, and a woman in a field dominated by men. VOA's Munaza Shaheed profiles the talented young jewelry maker.
Sayeda Etabari lost her hearing after contracting meningitis as a newborn. She never learned to speak and communicates in sign language. But she went on to get what in the United States would be a high school diploma and mastered the art of designing and crafting gem-studded jewelry, which she markets online.
My older brother introduced me to Turquoise Mountain, where I took a test and was selected for training for making jewelry.
Turquoise Mountain is a British charity working in Afghanistan to restore the country's cultural and historic heritage. It held an exhibit last year at the Smithsonian Institution's Freer Sackler Gallery featuring Afghan artists. It included jewelry Etabari designed and made.
I went to the museum 1 year ago where my work was on display. There were people from many different countries and they were asking where I was from. They were surprised and wondered how I learned the art and how I got there.
Itabadi says she likes to work on intricate designs, even if they take hours to complete. She often combines traditional Afghan and contemporary motifs in her work and says she feels connected with people through her jewelry. Munaza Shahid, VOA Dewa, Kabul, Afghanistan.
Soccer is the most popular sport in the world, and in Pakistan, where the sport is called football, there's no shortage of fans. Although football is still considered a man's game in Pakistan, in Lahari town, in the country's largest city of Karachi, it's gaining rapid popularity with a new group of fans, young girls. Shayan Saleem has details as Shuji Jan narrates.
Young men play football from sunup to sundown, and because of the sport's popularity in this suburb of Karachi, Lahari is often called the Little Brazil of Pakistan. But football is not just a boys' game anymore. Clad in traditional scarf and burqa, and carrying her own football, Mahjabeen Muhammad is ready to reclaim the field from the boys, so she can warm up with her fellow team members.
When I go out to play football, people say this game is not meant for girls. Even my cousin stopped me from playing football, but my father supports me and I fear no one. I love to play football and wish to have ground exclusively for girls, so that Lahari may become safe and there is security and girls could have their own lockers where they could change.
Mahjabeen developed a love for football by watching boys playing in the streets. But her interest in the sport intensified after she started watching international matches on television. Girls playing football is very new in this country, so these girls do not have their own football field. Instead, they have to wait for the boys to finish before they can play. Even as the boys watch and wait, these girls make the most of their time on the field. They can only play here once a month and only 1 hour at a time, but that hasn't discouraged them.
I have been playing football for the last 2 years. I convinced my father that girls can also do everything that the boys can.
I buy my shoes, football and other gear from my pocket money so that I could play comfortably.
I developed my interest in football after watching Brazilian player Neymar. I want to play like him, and that is why I am here playing football.
These girls are really eager to learn. They want to do whatever they see the coach doing and ask him how it is done. They watch matches and thereafter they try practice the same moves.
Lahari has developed a reputation for producing some of Pakistan's best football players. These girls say they're determined to join the ranks of Pakistan's best, but it will take more hours and more training playing on the boys' field. As if they had what it takes to become star players, these girls told VOA, maybe not today, but perhaps tomorrow. For Shayan Saleem in Karachi, this is Shuchi Jain, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia, Bollywood superstar Salman Khan is appealing a prison sentence he received last week for poaching in a case that has riveted India. One of India's most prominent actors, he was released from jail Saturday after a court granted him bail. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, wedding videos have come a long way from the days of poorly edited home videos. You may have some. Today we have the look and feel of full-fledged movie productions. That's thanks to advancements in consumer technology and the availability of high-definition cameras. Some of these wedding videos now rival the production values of some Hollywood films. As VOA's Tina Trin reports, one entrepreneur thinks the newest generation of wedding videos actually deserve their own channel.
Right now, it would be easy to think you're watching a movie trailer. There are the atmospheric scene setters, sweeping vistas, and aerial drone shots. But this is actually a wedding video.
I was thinking, this is the best content I've ever seen. It's real people, real stories, but professional production.
Rachel Silver is the founder of Love Stories TV, an online platform for watching and sharing professionally produced wedding videos.
We have thousands of wedding films from all over the world, and they've all been contributed by newlyweds or filmmakers.
So who exactly is tuning in? And is there really an audience for wedding videos of strangers?
Many of our viewers have grown up on reality TV. The Bachelor has been on television their entire lives. It's about the love story. Inevitably, in a wedding film, it comes out how you met, how you fell in love. They interview the friends and the family members, so you walk away with just this overwhelming sense of joy.
Besides its entertainment value, Love Stories TV may prove helpful when it comes to wedding planning, listing the venues, florists, dressmakers, and more depicted in each video, which are searchable by location, religion, culture, and even sexual orientation. Jennifer Thompson works for a wedding videography company and says the website has helped spur business.
It's a great place for us to, you know, contribute our work, get it in front of our, you know, more potential clients.
Cynics may roll their eyes at the self-congratulatory couples, but Silver, who regrets passing up the chance to have her own wedding documented, argues that these milestone moments are rare.
All of their family and friends and the people they love the most are surrounding them, and that only happens to you a handful of times in your entire life.
All the more reason, perhaps, to preserve the moment for posterity or late-night binge-watching. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
It may not have its own channel yet, but you can check it out on VOA Asia Facebook and our website at voanews.com. Dumping sewage into a local river is common practice in some of America's older cities. With the benefits of modern engineering, cities like right here in Washington, D.C. will soon be able to divert hundreds of millions of liters of raw sewage every day to wastewater treatment plants instead of a river. Arash Arabasadi has more.
About 30 meters below ground, an engineering marvel is about to change how wastewater in the nation's capital is returned to the environment. It's part of the Clean Rivers Project to upgrade centuries-old infrastructure called a combined sewer system, meaning rainwater and sewage share the same pipe.
During dry periods, everything goes down the water treatment plant. But when it rains, it's just too much for the pipes to handle, and this gets dumped right into the river. All this combined sewage goes right into the river.
DC Water is Washington's primary water utility. They've undertaken the challenge of cleaning the staggering 7,900 megaliters of untreated wastewater overflows into DC's two rivers each year.
And when there's a storm like this one, they ain't got time to clean you up before spitting you back out. You're not even water anymore. You're combined sewer overflow mucking up this city's rivers. It's a fate worse than boiling.
For a long time, the Anacostia River was basically an open sewer. Everything was just dumped into here from the system every time it rained.
So engineers came up with a plan. Here's how it works. Rainwater flows into a storm drain and into the existing sewer. DC Water would reroute and store about 378 megaliters of the combined overflow through large diversion chambers. And by tunneling under the river with an 8-meter-wide boring machine named Nanny, what used to be overflow would fill tunnels like this one before flowing into DC Water's state-of-the-art treatment plant in southwest Washington. When this portion of the project is fully operational in 2023, that number should jump to 98%. The entire Clean Rivers project will cost DC residents an estimated $2.7 billion. Engineers say the underground system of tunnels and sewers leading just to Washington's Anacostia River will stretch nearly 21 kilometers and cut system-wide overflow by as much as 96%, meaning cleaner water for residents and the millions of annual visitors to the nation's capital. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud. Download us as a podcast. We're streaming each and every day on VOA Asia Facebook and on our website at voanews.com. We're also heard on the radio. Wherever you go around Asia, check it out. Find us. Here's one place you can. It's in the Philippines. Falcon Radio at Adamson University. Thanks for taking our program. Thanks to everyone there who is listening today. We thank you for joining us, as we thank our director Tracy Carter and engineer Dave Magnus, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope you have a wonderful day.